This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Millions are forced to evacuate as the western states burn with unbearable heat and fire. We talk with David Wallace Wells, journalist and author of the book, The Uninhabitable Earth. Then from San Francisco, climate scientist Zeke Hausfather on his poisoned orange skies, fire fears, and how we could steer away from a worse catastrophe in climate change. Both interviews are loaded with facts and perspectives only on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get started. David Wallace Wells is one of America's best journalists covering climate change. He is deputy editor of New York Magazine. In 2019, David appeared on Radio EcoShock to discuss his popular book, The Uninhabitable Earth. His tweets about the heat and fires in California have been searing. David Wallace Wells, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
As you know well, California has experienced trial and heat by fire. How would you characterize the situation there?
At the moment, I would say it's basically out of control. I think that's likely to be a relatively temporary situation, but it's hard to keep track of all the fire, not just in California, but all up the west coast of the U.S. This is the result of an incredibly hot summer that baked the entire west coast and produced much more kindling for wildfire. And unfortunately, I think we're going to probably see it get a bit worse before it gets a little bit better. We are already in the worst fire season in recorded California history. The second, third, and fourth biggest burns that the state has ever seen are still currently burning. And there's another one that is fast rising up the list, the Bear Fire, which in just 24 hours burned through 250,000 acres, which is about 400 square miles. So this is, it's unprecedented. It's worse than the state has ever had it before. It also feels like, you know, our perspective is blurring such that we almost can't tell one fire from the next or one fire season from the next. It used to be the case in California that horrific seasons marked generations because they only came about once in a generation, but we're getting them now, if not every year, then every other year. And the state appears much more hostile to human life than it ever has before. As I was getting on the phone with you, got a text message from some friends in Southern California who just went to the playground with their daughter carrying a flashlight. And it's, you know, it's 11:30 a.m., but they couldn't see without a flashlight. This is a really, really horrific situation. And perhaps what worries me most is how little attention seems to be being paid to it by most of the national media and international media, in part because they're preoccupied by other things like the presidential election. But also, I think, because we're sort of all of us getting used to horrors like this coming as often now as they do.
Exactly. On September 9th, in the morning, I spoke with friends in Oakland, California. The daytime sky there was just like an orange night, as you describe. And it has to be hard on the kids, and it's hard on everybody. Maybe you'll have to write more about the new climate stress, David.
Well, I think many more people are feeling it directly. You know, a few years ago, dramatic climate change was something that we saw in the distant future. You know, there were scientists who saw it more up close, and people studying particular local impacts could see it happening in the present tense. But I don't think the population as a whole, in the U.S. especially, understood it as a drama that we were all already engulfed in. I think more and more people are seeing it that way, in part because of the dramatic, illustrative power of things like the California fires and many other impacts. I mean, it was less than 2 weeks ago that a hurricane made landfall in Louisiana, Hurricane Laura, and was followed immediately in that part of the country by a horrible heat wave. So people whose power had been knocked out by the hurricane then were dealing with incredible heat. And of course, in California, these fires come immediately. It's been a long, hot summer, but it comes immediately on the heels of a truly historic heat wave in which many, many records were set. The heat record for the entire planet was set in Death Valley a week or two ago. So as that perception grows, the perception of the planet changing and becoming more hostile to human life, of course, the emotional, psychological impacts are going to expand, hitting more people and hitting them more intensely. I do think, you know, when it comes to California fires, of course, it's important to keep in mind that this is not simply the result of climate change. And by that, I don't mean to say, oh, it's the result of the gender reveal party and the guy who set off the fireworks, or the, you know, the down power lines that caused the fires, so many of the fires in 2018. What I mean is that, you know, for a generation, we've done a really, really bad job of managing our wildland in the United States, trying to suppress fires at all costs. And as a result, we have much more dry kindling than we would have otherwise. So there was a report out, a quite pedigreed, well-regarded report that came out this January saying that California could sort of stabilize its current fire situation and make it bring it back down to the historical norm if it proactively burned about 20 million acres. So if it went ahead and in what are called controlled burns, where, you know, Cal Fire monitors human caused fires in order to sort of clean up the woods. If we burn 20 million acres, we could sort of restabilize the state's wildfire situation, at least for the time being. Now, climate change will continue to make it worse, will continue to produce more fuel, continue to produce more fires, but we'd be on a much more even keel heading into that future if we were managing our forests properly. The problem is, you know, 20 million acres is not some insignificant amount of land. It's 10 times the size of all of the fires that we've seen this year put together, which, as I said, is the worst fire season in recorded history. And while, you know, thousands of years ago, we had much more intense fire seasons, of course, there were very many fewer people living there. You know, today we have 40 million people living in the state of California, and 60% of the new residential development in the state since 1990 has been in wildfire-prone areas. So we're building out California, as we're growing the state's population, more and more of those people are living in areas that are vulnerable to these sorts of fires, rather than in places that, you know, in theory at least could be protected from them. So we're sort of damaging our own future from every angle. We're damaging the climate, but we're also building in the wrong ways and not protecting ourselves. We're also not managing the forest in the way that we need to. So we could be in a somewhat better place if we really did everything, you know, in our power. We'd still be looking at a somewhat bleak future, but I think we can at least hope that something like what is happening this year doesn't have to be an annual thing if we don't let it become that.
Well, I totally agree. It's not just climate change. It's the way we're living in so many aspects. But there are four elements to these rolling disasters in California that are at least made worse by climate change. I mean, there's been a drought for about 20 years long, an extreme storm with more lightning than anyone had seen. Then you had the unheard of heat that you mentioned and the inevitable grand finale of wildfires burning millions of acres. But why don't we start with that drought? A few years ago, we had NASA scientist Jay Famiglietti on Radio EcoShock, and he explained new satellite work shows California has lost so much groundwater, the change in mass can be measured from space. Now, some of that's home use, some of it's industrial and agricultural use, some of it's water management. But, David, what have you heard about the great drought enveloping the Golden State for years?
Well, yeah, it's a portent of what's to come, unfortunately. These are the kinds of droughts that, you know, in the distant human past used to buckle whole civilizations. It's just really hard to survive conditions like these. And it's important to keep in mind when we're talking about droughts like this, it doesn't mean literally that there's no water. It just means that there's so much less water than the region is used to, that many of the local ecosystems and the people living on them are suffering as a result. So, you know, it's not just California. It's really across the whole American West. We've been dealing with one of these sort of millennial droughts. You know, they're bigger than a 100-year drought. That's bigger than a 500-year drought. It's something like a 1,000-year drought. I think the last one of this scale that we saw in the American West was the one that destroyed the Anasazi civilization there. So it is a challenge of unprecedented proportions, and by that I mean, you know, obviously there are precedents in the climate record, but never when there was as much human civilization built up in these areas to depend on the stability of ecosystems and the climate, which are falling into deep instability. I think that's something it's really worth focusing on and keeping in mind, which it's not just that, you know, the climate is changing. It's not just that droughts are getting worse or wildfires are getting worse. It's that we've built up onto the foundation of these ecosystems enormous structures that we call civilization, but which can crumble when that foundation crumbles. And what we're seeing in the case of the drought, in the case of the increased wildfire risk, is more or less precisely that. The climate that we built our civilization on top of is changing quite rapidly, much more rapidly indeed than at any point in planetary history. And as a result, everything that we've ever taken for granted as permanent features of modern civilization or human culture I think is being revealed to us as much more conditional, much more fragile, and much more precarious. How we respond to that is an open question. I think there are some paths we can take, as I was saying a minute ago, that make things a little bit better. But the basic fact of our entire civilization resting on unstable ground, I think, is something that should give us all pause.
Definitely. And then there's the heat. When I lived in Los Angeles in the 1970s, and yes, I'm that ancient, nobody had air conditioning. And why would you need it in a climate like paradise? You just open a window, the ocean is there. Last week, part of Los Angeles County hit 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 49 degrees C. It was 109 Fahrenheit in downtown LA, 42 C, right by the sea. And that sounds more like the Middle East hotspots you warned about in your book, The Uninhabitable Earth. As a climate journalist, did you expect to be writing these stories so soon about an American state?
Well, you know, I've been covering climate pretty seriously for, I guess, something like 5 years now, 4 or 5 years, so not as long as some of my colleagues. And I have to say, the period of time when I've been working so seriously on it, that kind of news just hasn't stopped. So if you would ask me in 2016, 2017, if I would expect, you know, global heat records to be set in the American West, I might have told you I didn't. But the number of records that are being broken every year, every week, every month, is just so overwhelming that you do sort of start to expect more and more alarming news. That's just the path that we're on. You know, when you see the kind of the incredible flooding that we've seen across South Asia, the typhoons that have been hitting East Asia just this last week, the incredible locust clouds that are swarming over East Africa, devastating crops on which tens of millions of people depend. You know, the heat wave that you mentioned is an extreme American example, but it's truly the whole world that is being assaulted, you know, one day after the other, one week after the next, by some of these extreme impacts. And they can be quite whiplashy. Over the last few days, I believe the high temperature in Denver reached something like 98 degrees Fahrenheit, and then 2 days later was at 36 and it was snowing. One of the towns that's been evacuated in California is Oroville, which had to be evacuated 2 years ago because of the risk of a dam overflowing 2 years ago because of historic rains. And now they're dealing with unprecedented fire threat and having to evacuate because of that. So we're dealing in more and more places with what I call in my book climate cascades, which is to say it's not just one discrete impact, no matter how large and scary. It's one after the other, each making our ability to respond and recover more difficult because our capacity in terms of public policy and public financing, but also just emotional capacity, our social capacity, all of that is being diminished by each successive extreme weather event or natural disaster. And when you start to see more and more of these piling up one on top of the next, it's just really hard to imagine any kind of local government or local community that would be capable of truly surviving intact. That's how dramatic and intense and punishing some of these impacts really are.
David, I just searched news outlets for the total number of Californians evacuated because of the fires, but the truth is, right now, nobody knows. At the start of this wave of heat around August 20th, at least 175,000 people were evacuated. I have to think it's more now. And during the last few weeks, millions have been on the move and the freeways are crowded. It gives me the chills to wonder, what do all those displaced people mean for the numbers of COVID-19 cases in the next few weeks? It's like climate change and the pandemic are twins almost.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was just talking about climate cascades. I didn't even mention the pandemic. But of course, that makes all of this much, much worse. It makes emergency management and disaster management much, much worse. And, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the pandemic outcome of these evacuations will be. But there was a paper this week which, you know, some have thought maybe the estimate may be a little bit high, but suggesting that the Sturgis motorcycle rally in one of the Dakotas, actually, I think it's South Dakota, where 460,000 people recently attended, was responsible for 250,000 additional COVID cases. Now, I don't think that we're going to see a spike of that kind in California, in part because most of the evacuees are going to be traveling, you know, not to one large congregation area, but to the homes of their friends and family. But it's certainly likely to be some amount of transmission vector at a time when we're heading into the fall when we really don't want to be risking more transmission at all. on top of that, you know, because of the heat wave, people are needing relief from temperatures. They're unable to open their windows because of the wildfire smoke and how toxic that is. You know, something like 80% of San Francisco homes don't have air conditioning at all. And the Bay Area is still, you know, enclosed by these three major fires burning continuously. So we have public health calamities and crises just about everywhere you look, even discounting the global pandemic that we're living through, which is should be paramount in everyone's mind. But, you know, given the how terrifying some of these California stories are, sometimes it's possible to even forget that we're living through a disease that is already killed about 200,000 Americans and will likely kill many more before all is said and done.
And then we have millions of folks who don't have a home they can evacuate from. And I'm talking about the bulging California prison systems, as some of them already filled with smoke and COVID-19, and all those people already homeless in that wealthy state. It's legendary. What happens for them when the climate goes into overdrive like this?
Well, I think the situation is really quite bad for both of those populations. You know, I know that there has been, you know, some significant new outreach to the homeless throughout California this year and in the last few years, but it's a moral indictment on its own terms. But when you combine it with the impact of climate change to which all those people are being exposed daily and nightly, that, you know, just intensifies the moral crime of it. The prisons are, you know, in certain ways worse. Few of them are air-conditioned. Until this year, you know, prisoners were among the frontline firefighters in the California fires because Cal Fire couldn't find enough people outside the prison system to do the work they needed. So they hired inmates, paying them about $1 an hour to stand on the front lines of wildfires. That program has been interrupted this year in part by COVID, but it's bleak. I mean, every angle you look at this crisis from gives you a different sense of the shape of the calamity and the humanitarian horror. But that doesn't mean that, you know, there aren't still more yet to be uncovered. It's still very early in this story. And, you know, I think the suffering is only going to increase, unfortunately.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, here with American journalist and author David Wallace Wells. We were talking about the record-smashing heat and wildfires in California. As we speak, the sky above my studio is filled with haze and smoke in British Columbia. My wife has been packing photo albums in boxes in case we have to run away. Washington State is burning. There's a fire so close to the border that Canadian fire planes were called out to water bomb the little town of Curlew in Washington State. Oregon has very big fires, as you mentioned, but that's all getting less news coverage than protests in Portland. David, is it fair to say our current media system just breaks down during major climate-driven events, that they're unable to cover it all?
Well, I would say that we're not trying very hard, I say, as a member of the media. You know, I think it's not just the fault of the media. I think it's also a reflection of the sort of attention span and set of interests of the average news consumer. You know, the news business is a business, and it does respond to those cues more dramatically than any sort of ideological goals are. But I think it's absolutely a failure that, you know, most of the writing in the country's major newspapers about the wildfires hasn't mentioned climate change. In fact, much of the coverage of the historic heat wave didn't mention it, which is an even more egregious error because climate change is a much bigger part of the heat wave. You know, it's much more directly responsible for the heat wave than for some of these fires, although, as we talked about earlier, of course, it's a part of the fire story. The question of how to fix that and where to go from here, I think, is quite complicated. From my perspective, it should be relatively easy to take the initial first step of just saying, when writing about an extreme weather event or natural disaster like some of these are, you know, just to say these events are made more common by climate change, or this is in part the result of climate change. That doesn't seem all that hard to me to do, even in, you know, a 30-second TV news clip. But few people in those positions seem interested in or willing to do that, no matter how small the ask is. And they certainly haven't yet taken on in any dramatic, direct way the need for all-encompassing wallpapering the front page of the newspapers quite regularly kind of coverage of the climate crisis, which is frankly, I think, what you would want to see if you understood just how large and scary that crisis really is. I think, you know, extreme weather is a unfortunate but powerful propagandist. I don't think that people see images of California wildfires anymore and don't think about climate change. But the media writ large has been unwilling to do the really vital work, I think, of driving that point home, and in particular, the point that things are only going to get worse, and how much worse they will get is a matter for us to decide as a society. So this is not a question of entering into a new normal, but as I write in my book, it's the kind of, you know, the end of normal. We've left normal behind, and exactly what kind of future we're heading into is not yet determined.
You know, usually when these heat waves and fires subside, we see a generic estimate of billions of dollars in losses. They said the 2018 California fires cost about $26 billion, 22,000 buildings destroyed, 97 civilians and 6 firefighters killed. Is there a point where even wealthy America just can't afford to pay for hit after hit of extreme weather, whether it's hurricanes or fires, all the things we're seeing, as climate change progresses?
Well, I would like to think that relatively soon we will be taking much more aggressive action to protect ourselves from some of these impacts. So it's not just going to be a matter of totaling up the devastating costs and wondering whether it was worth it to be living in that place or building out, you know, in that area in the first place, but a matter of really reorganizing the way in which we live so that we're not building out new developments and floodplains on the Gulf Coast, and we're not building new homes in the wildland urban interface in California. And when we do that, we make sure that, you know, at the very least, you know, the insurance policies that cover those homes reflect the actual climate realities that they're facing, so that at the very least, the homeowner or the builder, the developer, is taking those costs into account in their own plans. Now, I would rather see an even more aggressive policy implemented in which, you know, say certain regions of the state were prohibited from being built on. But even short of that, I think you can see, and you are already seeing in some parts of the country, movement in finance, in the insurance markets, away from, you know, or towards a sort of reckoning with the meaning and scale of climate change. Now, you know, I think a lot of this is quite hard to quantify and analyze. On the other hand, you know, that is what those working in financial markets would say their greatest social value is in calculating risk and allowing, distributing risk and allowing the, you know, the country as a whole, the economy as a whole to operate despite some real risks. We haven't seen those interests managing our land and our housing and our development responsibly to this point. But I think we're starting to see the beginnings of that just over the last few years in bond markets and insurance markets. And I think we're likely to see that story, you know, become a bigger and bigger part of our response to climate change in the years ahead. The question is, to what extent can that be determinative? And I think despite what those in working in those markets and trying to do so responsibly might tell you, a lot more warming is already effectively baked in, and because of the building patterns that we've allowed over the last generation, a lot more Americans are going to be coming into contact with extreme weather and natural disaster like this, almost no matter what we do going forward. I mentioned earlier, 60% of new residential building in California since 1990 is in areas that are prone to wildfire. That means that well over a million new homes in California are in real risk of wildfire damage. That is a lot of people and a lot of homes. And no matter what we do going forward in terms of rezoning, in terms of changing the way that we conceptualize fire insurance, et cetera, all of those people who are already standing in the path of fire are going to be standing in that path going forward, even as those fires intensify, even as climate change makes the state more flammable and makes more heat waves, more droughts, and perhaps even more lightning storms like the ones we saw over the last few weeks more common.
Well, what they did in Alberta, where there were major floods, was the government, there was no insurance for those floods, by the way, so the government helped out the homeowners, but they said to them, we'll do this once, but if you rebuild the same place on the same property, we're not going to cover you, nobody's going to cover you. So that's one way of handling it. Now, on September 8th, the New York Times revealed a report from U.S. financial regulators appointed by Trump. It's titled Managing Climate Risk in the Financial System. I want to read you one quote in reaction to that report and get your reaction to that quote. One Republican on that Commodity Futures Trading Commission interpreted the new report as a warning about the financial risk of going green. He said, quote, The subcommittee's report acknowledges that transition risks of a green economy could be just as disruptive to our financial system as the possible physical manifestation of climate change, and that moving too fast too soon could be just as disorderly as doing too little too late. What is your reaction, David?
Well, that report hasn't itself been published, so it's a little hard to say what they found before, you know, while just reading news reports of it. And I guess I would say I wouldn't be shocked if there was some indication along those lines in a report that was put together by a committee formed under the Trump administration. Obviously, on its face, it's a kind of preposterous talking point. Of course, rebuilding our energy systems away from oil and gas and towards, you know, wind, solar, and possibly even nuclear will be disruptive. That's the scale of the challenge in front of us. Those businesses, those existing businesses, the fossil fuel businesses, do employ hundreds of thousands of Americans, and our electricity grids are dependent on them. But the best analysis that I've seen of what that transition could look like is that rushing through it would create something like 25 million jobs and would pay for itself in relatively short order. Now, that's not to say there wouldn't be some disruption along the way. You know, some people would be put out of work. Some people would have some disruption to their electricity supply to some degree. I think that that's built into any transition, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise. But the benefits of that transition are enormous, indeed, bigger than any sort of top-down intervention that's been undertaken in American history since the New Deal. And I think that we should think about that transition in those terms, not just as a producer of some disruption, but a producer of enormous widespread benefits that would especially accrue to the poor and marginalized people of color in our country, the people who need it most, in other words. You know, this is the case in part because getting us off of fossil fuels produces such an enormous benefit in terms of air quality that the public health upside of decarbonizing means that simply the quality of life improvements and public health improvements from better air quality would pay for the entire climate transition on its own without taking into any account whatsoever the costs of extreme weather and natural disasters that you'd be preventing by helping limit climate change. In other words, if we were able to, say, limit global warming to 1.5 degrees as opposed to 2 degrees Celsius, the transition required to do that would be paid for entirely through the public health benefits of better air quality. You don't even need to treat it as a climate issue. You can just treat it as an air quality issue, and the dollars and cents add up very obviously, making the case that we should move forward and do as much as we can, moving as quickly as we can, to bring about, you know, a renewable American future.
David, as we wrap up here, your article and book on the uninhabitable Earth went viral. It's still popular. Are you considering a new book?
Well, I'm working on a few pieces that, who knows, if they take off, may end up growing into a bigger project, a bigger book project. The one sort of big question that I've been spending some time on lately is the sort of adaptation side of the equation. That is, taking for granted the fact that the world is likely to warm at least 2 degrees Celsius, what will it take for us to live relatively comfortably in that future? You know, in addition to all of the decarbonizing we need to do to stabilize the planet's climate at something like 2 degrees, we're probably going to have to do a lot more in terms of protecting cities and coastlines from sea level rise, in terms of engineering new kinds of crops that can grow better in heat, in terms of air conditioning, all of that. The adaptation side of the equation, I think, has sort of been underappreciated, at least by the public. And it may prove as big or bigger a challenge than what's called the mitigation side of the equation, which is how we limit carbon emissions and ultimately decarbonize. That's where I've been focused lately. And of course, the California wildfires are just another indication that the world out there is already quite grim and brutal. And considering that it's going to get much more so in the decades ahead, we probably need to do a lot more than we are today to protect ourselves from it.
How can people follow your work?
Well, you know, the best places are New York Magazine, where I write a regular column about climate change, and on Twitter, where I'm a kind of embarrassingly active tweeter and retweeter.
I love your Twitter feed. I follow it myself. We've been talking with climate journalist, author, and deputy editor of New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells. Find links to learn more in my own weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you for coming on the show during such crazy busy times.
Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
At a peak moment of California wildfires, I reached climate scientist and energy specialist Zeke Hausfather. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. Dr. Hausfather has been chief scientist and co-founder at private energy firms, also a research scientist at Berkeley Earth, and climate analyst for Project Drawdown. Zeke, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's great to be here. My primary affiliation is I'm the director of climate and energy at the Breakthrough Institute, which is a think tank in Oakland, California.
As we talk on September 9th, what is it like in the Bay Area?
Well, the sky at the moment is orange. This morning, I thought it was still nighttime, even though it was 9 a.m. because it was so dark outside. We woke up with a layer of ash covering our car, and we're up half the night because we're worried that my mother-in-law's house in Talent, Oregon may have burnt down during the rapidly spreading fires yesterday. So catastrophic is probably the word that comes to mind for conditions at the moment.
There were a lot of homes burned in Talent. Did you find out what the situation there is?
So it's hard to know. We found a YouTube video of someone driving through the city, which seemed to show the area where my mother-in-law's home was located is mostly unburnt. So we're hoping for the best, but we won't know for sure until they let people back in.
It is hard to get news. We had a fire here in 2017, and for 2 days, we didn't know whether the town next to us had burned down or not. Authorities were waiting to make an official press release, I guess. So getting to California, digging around on NBC Bay Area TV, I found that on September 7th, the temperature in San Francisco was 83 degrees Fahrenheit, 28 C, at 11 o'clock at night. And that is higher than the average daytime high in San Francisco for early September. So now nights are hotter than days. Is it climate change time yet, Zeke?
We are certainly seeing the effects of climate change on heat in the San Francisco Bay Area and in California more broadly. You know, back in the 1970s, or for that matter, the 1900s, we only had about 5 days here in the East Bay that got above 85 degrees on average for the entire year. Today, we're seeing about 15 days on average, with some years seeing as much as 30 days, so an entire month of the year where temperatures are over 85. You know, this past week we saw some truly extreme heat. It was about 110 degrees in the Oakland Hills where I live. San Francisco itself, I think, hit around 101. We saw some truly staggering numbers in Southern California with 120 degrees reached near Los Angeles. You know, we are seeing extremes today that would have been very, very unlikely 100 years ago or even 50 years ago before the warming we've experienced.
And California appears to be entering a historic long-term drought. That has happened before, records show, in the Middle Ages. Last spring, I noticed a paper, A. Park Williams led the paper in Science, Large Contribution from Anthropogenic Warming to an Emerging North American Mega-Drought. Do we know if the current drought underlying those tinder-dry forests is just a natural cycle, a big one perhaps, or is it human-made?
So when we talk about drought, particularly the type of drought that paper was discussing, we're really talking about a combination of two factors. The first is precipitation, so how much rain we're getting, which is what most people think of naturally when they hear drought. But the second is how hot it is, because even if the amount of rain doesn't change, if the temperatures increase dramatically, the soils are going to dry out a lot faster. You're going to have drier vegetation and drier conditions, more need for irrigation for crops, for example. And so what we've seen in California over the last, you know, century or so, and particularly over the last 30 years, is while the average amount of rainfall we've been receiving hasn't noticeably changed, the temperatures have gone up considerably. And that's led to much drier soils, much drier vegetation, and conditions that are really ripe for wildfires. And if we look at what climate models project, you know, they're very mixed on changes in precipitation. To be honest, about half of them expect where I live in Northern California to get wetter in the warming world, and about half expect them to be drier. But they do agree on a few things. First, they agree that the rainy season itself is going to shrink. So while the average amount of rain we get might not change, the rain is going to be much more concentrated on heavy downpour days, particularly in the rainy season here, which is in the winter months. And the second thing that they predict is that it's going to get much hotter. And so we're going to have much less soil moisture, much drier vegetative conditions. There's a paper by John Abogatsu and Park Williams a couple years ago where they actually argued that about half the increase in wildfire burnt area in the western U.S. over the last few decades is attributable to changing climate conditions, primarily driven by increasing temperatures. You know, we see on a year-to-year basis years that are hotter and drier tend to have much wider areas burnt. And it just makes sense that, you know, if vegetation is very dry, you're going to have, you know, fires that burn much wider areas. One really telling statistic is that in California, the number of fires that have occurred has actually declined over the last 30 years. We have less fires today than we had in 1980. But the area that those fires are burning has increased by about fivefold. So the amount of fires themselves hasn't really changed, or it's slightly declined. But the conditions on the ground have changed such that when fires do start, they tend to burn much larger areas. And those conditions are primarily driven by drier vegetation. Though there's also a role for vegetative buildup in our forests. The U.S. has been too good in some ways at preventing forest fires for much of the last century. So we've had a huge buildup of undergrowth in a lot of our forested areas, which contributes to, you know, much more dangerous fires when they do occur. So it's not just climate change to drive the increased fires, but climate change is clearly playing a large role.
Well, when you see fires like that, and you can see them from space just suddenly blowing up into big, big areas, it must release a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. Will that alone affect the warming?
So we're definitely seeing rapid intensification of fires. You know, just this past day, there's a fire near Oroville, California, that grew from nothing to 250,000 acres in the space around 24 hours. And now it's the ninth largest fire in the history of California, or at least in modern history. And yes, when forests burn, they release a lot of carbon that has been slowly absorbed by the trees and the soils over a century. And that can contribute significantly to global emissions. You know, land use is roughly 10% of global emissions. The other 90% is from us burning fossil fuels and a few chemical processes like cement production. But the portion that is from land use has been increasing in recent years, and much of that increase is attributable to forest fires in many regions of the world, such as the Amazon, Indonesia, the western U.S., and in the Arctic.
You just made my jaw drop with that description of the fire near Oroville coming up in 24 hours, just boom.
Yeah, and those sort of fires are extremely dangerous to people who live nearby because fires that grow that quickly can overwhelm communities before they have time to easily evacuate, as we saw in the tragic example of Paradise 2 years ago.
Yeah. Well, Zeke, in addition to being a climate scientist, you are also an energy analyst. What are you seeing in the California energy system during this incredible record-setting heat wave?
So the California energy system has certainly been stressed. You know, we had some brief rolling blackouts a few weeks ago that got a lot of attention. And part of that is that California has been undergoing a rapid energy transition in recent years. We've done a lot to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions, primarily through building a lot more renewable energy. Which has been, you know, generally a big success. Though it's also created some challenges because, predictably, when the sun sets, solar generation decreases. And so what California has been doing is we've been making up for a lot of the, you know, drop in solar generation from imports from neighboring states. So as the sun sets, solar generation declines, we start importing more and more from our neighbors, states like Nevada, for example. And what happened this time around was that our neighboring states were also suffering from this extreme heat wave, and so they didn't have as much power to give us as they normally could. And that, coupled with a number of natural gas plants unexpectedly going offline, led to these rolling blackouts. And so there seems to be a clear need for more dispatchable generation that can come online, you know, as the sun sets, be that from batteries, which are increasingly inexpensive and an exciting area of development, or at least in the short term from potentially more natural gas plants. Though obviously we don't want those around in the long term because they emit a significant amount of carbon dioxide and, you know, are not consistent with California's long-term climate goals. But at the moment, we have a bit of a demand crunch, and so the state needs to figure out how to fill that gap in the short term.
Elon Musk's company built a giant battery to balance power systems in Australia on pretty short notice, and I'm wondering if that is the kind of technology we need to look for, or is there some sort of storage in salt, or how can we answer this problem of nighttime power in a daytime generation setup?
So the cost of lithium-ion batteries, the type of batteries that Elon Musk used in the Australia project, has declined dramatically in recent years. And so California has built and is building a number of very large battery projects right now that are going to be coming online in the near future. And so that'll help a bit. But at the same time, if we really wanted to be able to power the entire grid off solar and wind in California, we'd need an enormous amount of batteries, you know, orders of magnitude larger than anything we're talking about today. Or we would need the ability to get power from much further distances away. One of the problems that the U.S. has right now is our power grid is ancient and in many ways falling apart. And much of it was built during the 1940s and 1950s. And it's also very balkanized. There is very little power that crosses between the eastern and western parts of the U.S. Texas is its own little island. And even within regions like the western U.S., there's relatively small interconnections between states compared to somewhere like Europe, where there's very large power lines spanning between countries and the ability to send, say, extra wind power from Denmark to the UK or Germany, or store power and pump storage hydro in Norway and then send it to France when needed. So one way we can help balance out the grid as we get more and more renewable energy is to invest in modernizing our grid and particularly invest in long-distance high-voltage transmission lines where we can, say, take extra wind in Iowa during the nighttime and send it to California in the late afternoon, which could significantly help, you know, deal with the period when the sun is setting and demand is rising. And so having an interconnected grid allows us to send extra sun and wind from places where the sun is shining and the wind is blowing to places where it's not. And that's really a needed aspect of a higher renewables grid. And there's also an increased recognition that we need more clean, firm generation to fill in the gaps between intermittent renewables. And that clean, firm generation come from a number of sources. There's a lot of exciting work being done around enhanced geothermal these days, the ability to get significant amounts of geothermal power out of, you know, lower temperature rocks than early traditional geothermal used. There's a lot of excitement around offshore wind, which still is somewhat intermittent, but has much higher capacity factors than onshore wind. You know, offshore wind, you can get power from 50, 60% of the time versus 20, 30% for onshore wind. And some technologies like advanced nuclear. There's an advanced nuclear reactor currently being built in Utah that'll be the first of its type, which is a relatively small and modular reactor. The challenge that nuclear has faced in the U.S., at least historically, is that, you know, it's become these huge bespoke engineering projects. And we're just really bad about building big projects on time and on budget today, be it, you know, the big dig in Boston or the big nuclear reactors in Georgia. And so by making nuclear reactors small and modular and being able to essentially pump them off an assembly line, we hope we can get the sort of economies of scale and learning that have characterized, you know, the solar and wind industries. And so there's a lot of people hopeful that advanced nuclear will solve some of these problems and give us a clean, firm source of generation that can be an important complement to a high renewable system.
You said in a tweet that hardly anybody in the Bay Area has air conditioners at this point. Do you think the heat wave will drive up sales of air conditioners in California and therefore push higher electricity demands during any heat wave?
I think that's definitely going to happen. Broadly speaking, as the world warms, we expect air conditioning usage to go up and to, in some ways, more than counterbalance reduced heating load. Certainly, we're considering getting a heat pump for our house in the next few years, because these sort of conditions are going to become increasingly more common. You know, we're hoping to balance it out by getting solar panels on our roof and a battery backup system. But going from not cooling your house at all to cooling your house is certainly going to drive up your energy use.
In July, you posted an update to the state of the climate on carbonbrief.org. Zeke Hausfather, how is it looking for climate change in 2020 so far?
So 2020 is definitely going to be an exceptionally warm year. Whether it's going to be the warmest year on record is still a bit of an open question and depends a bit on which of the international groups you look at. It seems more likely than not at this point that NASA and the Copernicus ECMWF group in the EU will have 2020 as the warmest year on record. We think that most other groups, including Berkeley Earth, which I contribute to, will probably have 2020 as the second warmest year on record. And these differences come from what ocean temperature series one uses, how you deal with missing data in places like the Arctic, where there's not many stations. So there's various methodological choices that result in small differences between the years. But the climate doesn't really care about if 2020 is the warmest or second warmest year, right? It's more concerned, it cares about the fact that the world has been consistently warming by about 0.2 degrees C per decade for the last few decades. And we expect that rate of warming will continue and potentially even accelerate slightly in the coming decades.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Zeke Hausfather, who is a climate scientist and also an energy expert. And we're talking about the situation in California, but also in the world more broadly. And in that broad world, in the middle of August, extreme heat stretched pretty well around the Northern Hemisphere. The U.S. South was steaming, but Europe was hot too. Siberia and the Arctic Circle hit highs over 92 degrees F, 32 C. That just doesn't happen there. Japan was boiling, 26 deaths in Tokyo alone.
In Siberia, for example, researchers found that without climate change, what happened in Siberia would be a 1 in 60,000 year event, so essentially an almost impossible event, whereas with climate change, it's about a 1 in 100 year event. By mid-century, at the rate we're warming today, it'll be a 1 in 10 year event, and by the end of the century, it could be an every other year event under a high emission scenario. So, you know, the type of extreme heat we're seeing has become much more common and much more possible due to the warming the world has experienced.
So in the past, extreme heat often occurred during an El Nino event in the Pacific. Is that true now? And if not, well, what would it have been like if El Nino had doubled up with these other heat factors?
So the effects of El Nino and La Nina conditions, for that matter, differ a bit for different regions of the world. But for the world as a whole, El Nino years tend to be considerably warmer, and La Nina years tend to be considerably cooler than average, or at least than the surrounding years. And so what is remarkable about 2020 is that it stands a decent chance of being the warmest year on record, despite modest La Nina conditions that have been developing in the Pacific, and neutral El Nino conditions, so no noticeable El Nino in the first half of the year. And so certainly if you adjust for the effects of El Nino events on the global temperature record, 2020 will be clearly the warmest year ever. The only reason why it might not be is because 2016, which is currently the record holder, had a super El Nino event pumping up global temperatures. And so the fact that, you know, we might see a neutral El Nino or modest La Nina year beat out a super El Nino year a few years back just goes to show how big an effect human emissions of greenhouse gases are having on global temperatures.
Is it still possible we could have a cooler than normal year or two, even as global warming progresses?
It depends what you mean by normal, right? You know, certainly you could have a couple years that are cooler than this year going forward. We're probably never going to see a year cooler than 2014, barring the eruption of a massive volcano or some sort of event like that. The largest El Nino event in the 1990s was in 2008, and 2008 was, at the time, an exceptionally warm year. Today, 2008 would be a remarkably cold year, and it's colder than almost all the years we've had in the last decade. And so while El Nino events can have a sizable effect on a year-to-year basis, the magnitude of climate change is much larger than the effect of El Nino over the course of decades.
And all this is happening over a background of the pandemic, and likely there have been over a million people evacuated from fires in the western states. We don't know yet. And even more are traveling around trying to escape the heat. It's likely to spread COVID-19 further. And this during a time when the federal government is not helping, sometimes makes environmental rules worse. Can the western states band together even more than they have been doing to do something about this, to try and adapt to a tough new reality?
We hope so. You know, one of the biggest influences on the spread of COVID-19 is actually how much time people spend indoors, because there's a lot of epidemiological evidence that transmission happens much more easily indoors than outdoors. And so one of the really pernicious effects of this extremely hot weather we've been having is that people are spending a lot more time indoors. And to the extent that they're doing that with other people outside of their immediate family, it certainly increases the risk of transmission. But more broadly, you know, in the U.S., the states actually have a remarkable amount of power in terms of setting their own environmental rules and regulations. And so, you know, we've seen states really step up during the Trump administration, or at least a certain subset of states, to increase their regulations to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. There's certainly been a lot of pushback by the Trump administration, perhaps most prominently in the battle with California over fuel economy standards for vehicles. But states have a lot of leeway to put into place their own carbon prices, their own cap and trade systems, all these sort of things that we've seen a number of states do. And we certainly could do more. You know, California is probably furthest out there of all the states in the country in terms of ambitious climate policy, but many others could follow California's lead. And, you know, hopefully come November, we'll end up with an administration that can do more on the federal level as well. Because, you know, while the states that are concerned about climate change, which are primarily those, at least in the moment, with Democratic governors and legislatures, can do a lot on climate change, the country as a whole won't necessarily if half the states are doing nothing on climate change. And so we really need federal action to get everyone moving in the right direction.
And what about corporate responsibility now that climate change is starting to show itself? I mean, just companies leaving the West isn't an option because climate change is creating new stresses pretty well everywhere. It could be storms somewhere else or something. So having worked in the private sector, what do you think companies large and small should do now that disaster is becoming more common, unfortunately?
Companies certainly need to prepare for the new conditions that are facing us. You know, we've seen huge shakeups, for example, in the insurance industry with the fires in the West, and large numbers of companies completely pulling out of that space simply because they can't bear the type of catastrophic risk exposure that they have by insuring folks in these regions. You know, more broadly, companies are often going to be followers rather than leaders of government action. You know, companies can push to an extent. They can take important measures around corporate social responsibility, but they're not going to fundamentally change until there are market forces to do so. You know, an oil company, for example, might invest a fair amount of money in a renewables division. They might invest in carbon capture and storage, but their primary business is going to be producing oil until it's not profitable to do so anymore. And so, you know, while it's important to put pressure on these companies and try to push them to change and them to lobby for policy to create, you know, more certainty and level playing field going forward, we also need that policy fundamentally to change the direction these companies are taking. And so, you know, while I'm a proponent of pushing companies to take more action on climate, I also am cognizant that in the absence of state and federal policy, there's going to be limits to how far that can go.
I'm finding I have to work a little bit harder to find some happy times. How do you cope, Zeke, knowing what you know about climate change?
So I try to focus on where the good news is. And, you know, despite all of the doom and gloom, literally gloom outside right now, there are some bits of hope we're seeing. You know, some of the worst case outcomes of climate change seem less likely now than they did a decade ago. Our business as usual scenario that we used to refer to and a lot of climate change projections assumed that the world's emissions would triple by the end of the century, that we'd be using, you know, 5 to 6 times more coal by 2100 than we are today. And thankfully, that seems to be unlikely to pass at this point. You know, global coal use peaked back in 2013 and has been declining since then. We're going to see record declines this year. So obviously, there's other factors at work, too, in 2020. And, you know, there's many parts of the world now where renewable energy is cheaper than coal and where clean energy is the cheapest option for countries to go with. And so, you know, while we're still very far from on track to meet, you know, the Paris Agreement targets of limiting warming to well below 2 degrees, it seems like the world is probably more on track for 3 degrees of warming now than the 4 or 5 degrees that seemed like the likely pathway a decade or two ago. At the same time, you know, there's big uncertainties involved in predicting future climate change. You know, our emissions are obviously one big uncertainty. But on top of that, you know, there's something we call climate sensitivity, essentially how much the world is going to warm if you increase CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, if you double them. And that itself is hugely uncertain. If you double CO2, you could end up anywhere between about 2 degrees and 4.5 degrees of warming. And that's a range that has been fiendishly tough to narrow by climate scientists over the years. In addition to that, you know, there's uncertainties in how the ability of the land and the ocean to take up our carbon emissions will change as the Earth warms, what we call carbon cycle feedbacks. And so when you take all that into account, while our best estimate is that the world is on track today with current policies to warm about 3 degrees, that could really end up being anywhere from 2 degrees to 4.5 degrees. The 4.5 degrees if we sort of get unlucky with the dice rolls of climate sensitivity and carbon cycle feedbacks. And so we're certainly nowhere near out of the woods yet and not on track for where we want to go, but we seem to have made at least some progress. We're no longer living in a business-as-usual world. And so I take some hope from that and the fact that it's going to be a lot easier to bend the curve of emissions down to 2 degrees from where we are today than where we were 10 years ago in terms of climate policies and energy technologies.
Zeke, do you have special projects you're working on these days?
I have a few interesting projects in the works. You know, We recently published a big paper trying to narrow down this range of climate sensitivity that I was just talking about, sort of combining evidence from the Earth's distant past, from historical observations, and from sort of physics-based modeling to try to, you know, get a better sense of where we'll end up. And so we suggested that instead of the 1.5 to 4.5 range of warming that was in the last IPCC report, it should really be about 2.3 C to 4.3 C or so. And so, that, you know, it's still a wide range, but it's a bit narrower. I also have a big report on climate tipping points that's under review now and hopefully will be out later this year, sort of looking across all the different climate tipping points we talk about and getting a better sense of which are sort of really tipping points versus, you know, are better thought of as feedbacks, and the extent to which there's a potential for sort of a tipping point cascade to happen. We suggest that, you know, while it's something to worry about, there's not much firm evidence in that regard that, you know, the ice sheet's disintegration could then trigger some other big tipping point, in at least in the sort of time frame we care about for human civilization, you know, the scale of centuries. You know, once you start going out millennia, then much bigger sort of interconnected system changes are more easily possible. But, you know, I don't want to talk too much about it because it's not out yet and it might change as part of the review process, but we hope to have that out later this year.
Well, let's talk about it as soon as it comes out. I'd love to do an interview with you then.
Definitely.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to talk about or tell our listeners?
And we covered a pretty wide range of things. There's one thing I do want to emphasize about climate change is the one slightly comforting thing for me, at least, is that at least our models of climate change are not that tippy. You know, it's not like if we mess up and pass 2 degrees, suddenly something kicks in to cause warming to spiral out of control and the Earth turns into Venus and the oceans evaporate. Like, that sort of thing doesn't really happen in our models, at least. You know, models are obviously not perfect, but... And so, you know, I like to tell people that climate change is really more of a matter of degrees than thresholds. 2 degrees is worse than 1.5 degrees. 3 degrees is much worse than 2 degrees. 4 degrees is much, much, much worse than 3 degrees. And so if for some reason we don't get our act together, which I hope we do, we shouldn't lose hope. In fact, the longer we wait, the more important it becomes to mitigate emissions further, because the damages of climate change increase non-linearly with the amount of warming. The real takeaway from that is, you know, we shouldn't lose hope. We shouldn't think we're all doomed. Climate change is a huge and pressing issue, but it's one we need to continue pushing against and continue fighting, even if, you know, things don't move as fast as we hope they will.
From California, we've been speaking with Dr. Zeke Hausfather, climate scientist and energy expert. You can find links to follow up on Zeke in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening to this Radio EcoShock special on climate, wildfires, and extreme heat in the West. Be sure to join us again next week for more on your world.